You're listening to the Ruhi Sleep, Sleep in Society podcast, recorded in Kingston, Ontario, Canada.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of Sleep in Society. I'm your host, Ruhi Snyder. And today, joining me on Sleep in Society is Dr. Joe Nash. Joe is a neuroscientist, an academic, an enthusiast, and I'm very excited to have a conversation on the brain, his path to academia, and how he is managing during these challenging times that we are all living in. Welcome, Joe Nash.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm excited.
Oh, me too. How are you doing, Joe?
I am always good. I can't complain.
I know. And this is very interesting because I'm going to take us back to the first time we met at the CrossFit gym. Mm-hmm. And we were having a conversation. We just said hello. And I, you know, like the polite, awesome, polite Canadians we are, we always ask how the other person is. And I said, how are you? And you said, I'm always good. And that to me, it's stuck in my head at that particular point that you were in a constantly in a steady state. And I was quite intrigued by that whole idea of being in a steady state because I was studying, I was deep into homeostasis and allostasis at that particular point, these subjects that I was studying. So a steady state, tell me about your steady state.
Well, you know what, I kind of just have a little bit of a routine, I guess, and don't take anything for granted, especially under the circumstances right now going on in the world. So I'm pretty fortunate to put things in perspective, and I think that's why I just I feel the way that I do, I guess. I'm doing all right. It could be a lot worse, so I'm good. I'm good. So that's kind of how I feel.
So I said that Dr. Joe Nash, I want to explain that you are a neuroscientist.
Yes.
And you're studying the human brain, and you have had your one PhD in neuroscience already.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. And yes, now you're absolutely correct.
You're doing two degrees at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
How incredible is that?
I'm not sure how incredible it is,
it's
but
pretty
it's
incredible.
I, like I said, feel fortunate to be able to do. I recognize the privilege to be able to do this. Currently, I'm doing my second PhD in translational medicine, and concurrently doing my MD here at Queen's as well. So. Yeah, it's pretty awesome. I'm lucky.
How are you managing? People have difficulty doing one degree, and you're doing two fairly difficult subjects, by the way.
Yeah. You know what? I'm lucky in the way that it's structured. It's we focus on either research or clinical aspects. Depending on the years that you're in the program. And right now, over the last year, I've been focusing on research and have been fortunate enough to be exposed to some clinical aspects. But mostly right now, it's research, which has been my, it really is a passion of mine, studying predominantly, like you said, the brain, mm-hmm. Specifically things like stroke and other neurodegenerative diseases. So.
Yeah, so
I'm very fortunate.
Can we talk a little bit about that? You're studying specifically stroke, and mm-hmm. Now we had a conversation. I tried to have a conversation to get an idea of where we're going to go with the podcast conversation in itself. And you and I had a pretty long conversation the other day. I think it was mm-hmm. last week. And You were talking about the idea of, in terms of like specifically about stroke, and you're looking at a very specific stuff in terms of stroke, and which is very, I found it very intriguing because it's related to movement.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So my first PhD was actually in motor control and neuroscience. So mm-hmm. understanding how the brain kind of helps you make the movements that we do. And I've kind of ported some of those ideas as well as some other ones into my new research field in translational medicine and stroke. And it's pretty interesting, actually. What I'm seeing on my preliminary data is some really, really neat things.
So I wanted to talk a little bit before, let's talk a little bit about motor control for those who don't understand what that means. Mm-hmm. Could you give us a definition of what it means by motor control, first of all?
Yeah. So the probably the most basic way is how we move mm-hmm. and why we move in the way that we do. So when we think of motor control, you can think of, well, you know, when you have, you know, a cup of coffee in front of you, we often make these straight movements towards it with mm-hmm. your arm instead of these, you know, kind of roundabout looping movements. And, you know, there's various parts that go into that. It's not only how do you control the muscles to reach out and grab that and, you know, pick up the coffee cup that you have in front of you, but it's also taking in the information around you. Where is the coffee cup? How do you, you know, can you see it? Can you feel it? So there's kind of two components to that, what you're taking in and mm-hmm. what you're putting out. And that kind of encompasses what motor control is, from my perspective anyway.
And you were talking about straight movements as compared to looping movements. What does that mean?
Yeah. So why doesn't your arm, you know, go behind, you know, up over your head and then reach down and instead of just, you know, if the coffee cup is sitting right in front of you, or why don't you make, you know, two circles with your arm before you actually go pick up the coffee cup? You know, it's really what it comes down to is we're you know, some of the ideas are that we're inherently lazy as human beings,
or conservation of energy.
That's exactly mm-hmm. it. We want to conserve as much energy as possible. Mm-hmm. So instead of, we make these very efficient movements mm-hmm. and to be able to do that, as I alluded to earlier, you need to be able to take in information about your environment, you know, where the coffee cup is, how much it weighs, you know, what does it feel like to be able to actually pick it up and bring it to your mouth? And that part includes coordinating the muscles and the different joints. And so there's a lot that goes into it, which mm-hmm. is really
how
neat.
Incredible is that? And then what happens with stroke? What happens to when somebody has a stroke?
So stroke is a little bit of an umbrella term. Mm-hmm. There's two main types of stroke. And essentially, your brain, the neurons in your brain, they need oxygen and nutrients. Mm-hmm. And what provides that is the vasculature. So the arteries and veins, arteries provide it and veins take it away. And what you can really think of as stroke is a bit of a plumbing problem with those arteries. And there's two main types. Mm-hmm. The first one is an ischemic stroke. And what that is when that pipe gets plugged effectively. So beyond where the plug is, there's not much blood getting to those regions of the brain. So they suffer mm-hmm. and unfortunately die off. And then the other one, which is less common, is a hemorrhagic stroke, and that's when essentially the pipe bursts. And again, beyond that point, the areas that really need the blood are not receiving it because it's spilling out earlier on in the pipe, mm-hmm. basically, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. So what does it do? What does it do to the brain then? So let's, after stroke, some parts of the brain are not able to communicate with other parts of the brain. Is that what's happening? Like neurons are...
Yeah, that's, you know what, that's effectively what happens is those areas that need those nutrients, they die off effectively. And the connections that they have with other areas of the brain, they're no longer there. So then what ends up happening is to be able to recover, you have to have other areas of your brain that pick up the slack. And what we refer to that as is compensation or plasticity. And that's really what, you know, drives recovery. Those individuals who have improved basically areas of the brain that pick up the slack.
And so, how does one go about that? Is it possible to recover some of those movements? Like, are you able to recover some of the movements? Because with stroke, movement is one of the things that's affected the most. Like speech is affected, movement is affected. Is there a way to recover?
There is. And, you know, I wish I could have like a very clear cut answer for you, but to be honest,
any answer would do.
With rehabilitation and practice, you can recover a lot of your, I shouldn't say a lot. It depends a little bit on the stroke, where it is, how big it is, things like that, that they all play a part or a role in how you recover. And unfortunately, a lot of our studies that look at, you know, stroke and recovery, there's a lot of conflicting information on whether it's specific areas, how big the stroke is, all of that stuff, and how that plays out and relates to recovery.
And sorry to interject, but does prior learning process help? If you were, for example, if you knew how to move, for example, and you learned about movement as in terms of whether you were an athlete or you just practiced movement, is there any data showing that that might be actually helpful? If you have a prior sense of like learning how to, if you had a prior sense of movement itself?
That's, you know what, that's a good question. I don't actually know. I don't think I've read any literature on that. And the problem with that is that we often look at people after they've had a stroke and don't do very much from them before they've had a stroke. So, it's kind of hard to tell what's happening before, or if any of that plays into a part. And in fact, that's it's funny that you bring that up. That's part of kind of what I'm doing right now.
Yeah,
in terms of my work. Yeah. So one of the things that we are kind of curious about a little bit is we use actually animal models to model stroke. And the reason for that is because, like I just mentioned, a lot of human studies, it's hard to get various people into the same project who've had the same stroke. You know, we just can't control for that. So animal studies allow us to do, you know, precision strokes and really look at a homogeneous population, meaning, you know, everyone's the same within it, and really look at what the outcomes are after that. And we have the luxury of doing that, looking at before and after the stroke, which is really wonderful in our lab. So
are you doing the brain scans?
Yes. So we actually do in our lab, I should mention, I work under Dr. DJ Cook, who's a translational scientist here in Kingston and a neurosurgeon. And he, you know, he took me on, and what my work with him has been is looking at both structural and functional scans of the brain and seeing how those changes actually relate to recovery of these individuals.
And are you, so these scans that you're doing, where are you with it? What is it showing to you guys?
So we actually have some really neat findings that we've had over the last little while. And one of the early ones that we found is, I just mentioned to you that, you know, there's a lot of components that go into recovery and movement,
mm-hmm.
in motor control. There's both how you take in the information and then how you output it. And what we're finding is that the animals that actually recover really well are those animals who have less injury to the sensory regions, which actually take in all the information from the world around you. And the ones who recover poorly actually have much larger deficits in those areas. And that's actually quite remarkable, because most people would think that it's actually the areas that are responsible for the output, the actual movement parameters. But it's more so contingent, it looks upon, looks like, you know, actually how we take in the information from around us.
So would that be, a lot of it would be a visual component?
So there's various aspects. You know, we think of one of the biggest sensory modalities is vision, mm-hmm. for sure. But there's also things like proprioception, which is just simply where you are in the world. And what I mean by that is, if you, you know, reach your arms out to each, either side of you, and I told you touch your nose,
mm-hmm.
you could do it looking at your hands. But you could also do it if I told you to close your eyes. And that's because you have a very good sense of where your arms are in space and where your nose is. So there's those components as well as tactile components, meaning touch and
mm-hmm.
feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So there's various modalities there that we actually take in. We put them all together and then use those to actually spit out something like a proper movement. Let's say, quote unquote.
And then is that sense somewhat lost when somebody has a stroke, because the brain is not actually able to talk, or the parts of neurons are not actually able to communicate with one another?
That's exactly it. That's the, our kind of working hypothesis right now, is that the thought is that, you know, because those sensory areas are not working well and can't communicate properly, you just, you're outputting things that are not guided properly. So yeah, I'm not sure if that actually makes sense.
No, okay, like, so yeah. For example, if a person with stroke has no sense of, you know, or where their arm is out in the space,
mm-hmm.
As compared to their nose. Now, to help them develop that, would you be actually teaching them, like to extend their arm and then put it towards their nose to give them that sense of that spatial sense?
There are rehabilitation techniques to help people with who've had stroke, and, you know, relearn or strengthen some of those pathways.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not entirely familiar with all of them. There's things like one of the ones that we were actually looking at recently was constraint movement therapy. And that's one of the things that people do, is when they get hurt or have a stroke or anything like that, they actually, you know, they compensate with the side maybe that's stronger.
Mm-hmm.
So what you actually do is, you know, hinder that stronger side. So they have to use the affected side a little bit more. And because of that, you're training not only the muscles, but the sensory input, and the brain has to work a little bit harder. And the hope or the thinking between all that is that other areas compensate in the mm-hmm. brain and help you actually relearn some of those and form some new connections to actually be able to do what you need to do.
Oh, how interesting, because it's the same thing in when we are training, like physical training, is mm-hmm. that you spend a little bit more time on your weaker side.
Right.
To create some form of an equilibrium, which mm-hmm. now this is so incredibly interesting, really. And I can spend like hours with you, and likely I'm going to actually over the next little while we are all quarantined to have further discussions on these. But I want to know now, Joe, how did you come to this? Give us a little bit. Tell us about your journey, please.
I mean, I would love to tell you it was a very linear.
Please don't. Yeah, please don't tell me it was linear.
It was not. It really was not.
Linear is boring.
My path is long and winding.
Oh, fabulous. The way I like those. Those are the best pathways. And
Yeah. I was, I started out, my undergrad was in electrical engineering, here at Queen's as well. I've done all my degrees at Queen's, and I reached the end of that realizing that I did not want to be an engineer. Something about, you know, working on a small part of someone's big project didn't really, really interest
settle
me.
With you.
And at the end of that, my undergrad, I was playing basketball, working three jobs, and kind of just waiting for something to, you know, smack me upside the head
and give me
a pointer.
Before we delve further into, I want to talk about your three jobs, please.
Okay.
You had three jobs while you're doing your degree, which sounds very familiar to me because that's exactly what I had to do.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So, yes, I worked at a nightclub. Mm-hmm. I was a bartender, and I also worked for a company called Alliance Atlantis. I was a promotions manager for the city of Kingston. And I was also a research assistant as well. So I just did all of that to kind of try and support myself as much as I could. And you know what? It taught me a lot about myself too. It wasn't easy, but it was good to learn those skills early on.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly, you know, as much as it was difficult at the time, it's something that, you know, like I said, it shaped me, like a lot of my experiences. So,
yeah, I think I find the same way. I would never take anything back because I think those were the most interesting experiences from which, like, I learned from my hardships the most, I think.
Yeah.
And it kind of gives you an insight into yourself, into your weaknesses, into your strengths.
Absolutely.
And I think it's a wonderful way of building ourselves up.
Absolutely.
And it gives you an interesting perspective on life itself, right? And then
It totally does.
So you're doing three jobs and you don't want to be an engineer anymore. You've decided this is not your route. Then what happens?
Then a friend of mine, I think he was a friend on the basketball team. He told me, hey, we have this, like, you know, experiment that we're doing in Kin, and, you know, you get paid $100 for it. And I said, say no more on there. I'll do it. and, you know, I showed up and all they had me doing really was lifting a box with this contraption on my back off the ground and onto a platform. And I must have done it maybe 150 times. And they hooked me up to a bunch of electrodes and weird things. And, you know, I remember sitting there and out of the corner of my eye seeing these oscilloscopes, and they were kind of firing, the signals on them were firing at the same time I was lifting. And I thought, oh man, that's neat. And the postdoc running the experiment at the time, you know, I was very fortunate. He explained everything to me and it was really cool about it. And I remember thinking, and I said this to him, I was like, oh man, I wish I could do something like this. And he's like, actually, you know what? You'd be very well suited to it because we need people who understand signals and systems. And as an engineer, you get that.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, okay. And he's like, here, let me write down a few names for you. And he wrote down a few names of people who I might go contact. And I did. And I was fortunate enough to have one of them take a big chance on me. And Dr. Linda McLean was my master supervisor in the School of Rehab and Biomechanics. And, you know, it was a very eye-opening experience. I got to research and, you know, in my undergrad, I was good, I wasn't great because I didn't really feel like I needed to, you know, put the pedal down all the time. Mm-hmm. And I remember she noticed that a little bit, and she pulled me aside and she told me, "Hey, you know what? You're blowing a golden opportunity here." And she's like, "You could be doing so much better, and you're frustrating me because you're not." So, you know, she had my 100% my best interests in mind. Mm-hmm. And I, instead of walking out of her office thinking, "Woe was me," I was like, "Thank you. Okay." And the next day I got back to the lab at 7 a.m. after, you know, our morning practice or whatever. And I stayed there until 5, until practice at night. And I did that for the remainder of my master's. And I was fortunate enough to get, you know, some good publications out of it. Mm-hmm. And that she really gave me the kick in the butt I needed.
Yeah, and she believed in you. And I think that's so important that somebody that believes in you, has your back, has your best interest, and is honest.
Yeah.
About it. What a wonderful gift.
Yeah, it was really great. And mm-hmm. at the end of it, I was really enjoying research. You know, it was, there's something about looking at data for the first time, forming hypothesis, and kind of being able to take information from XYZ and mm-hmm. consolidate them and put them all together. I felt a little bit like I found my niche, which was great. And she pointed me towards, she kind of did the same thing and gave me a bunch of names for people I could do my PhD with. Mm-hmm. And I went and interviewed with a lot of them across the country. But the best lab or best fit for me was still here at Queen's under Steve Scott. Mm-hmm. And we studied their motor control. And it was phenomenal. I learned a lot. I was in an extremely strong lab. I can't emphasize extremely mm-hmm. enough. There were some very bright people, and I got there feeling a little bit overwhelmed and thinking, what did I get myself into? Mm-hmm. But they brought me along well. It was really cool, and we got a number of fantastic publications out of it. Steve as well was tough on me but fair, and you know, he fostered my strengths and told me, you know, blatantly what my weaknesses are and what mm-hmm. I had to work on. And you know, because of him, I really feel I became a better scientist because of it. And at the end of that, I was looking to do a postdoc. Mm-hmm. And that's when DJ came into my life, and I met him, and kind of instantly we clicked. He was this larger than life guy, that this neurosurgeon and you know, pretty brilliant scientist. And I did a little independent study with him, and you know, it went really well. And at the end of that, he called me up and said, "Okay, I want you to do a postdoc with me." And I was like, "Oh, well, I kind of had some other opportunities that I was going to chase after."
And what were these other opportunities you were planning on chasing?
I was actually planning on going out to Calgary to do a postdoc out there. And then I had another one, an industry mm-hmm. Position offered to me that I was, you know, a little bit intrigued in, but I wasn't sure, to be honest. That was on the back burner a little bit, but
so you
the
ended
plan
up...
was to go to Calgary, but yeah, I ended up here at Queen's still again mm-hmm. With DJ, and he has been instrumental in my path. He kind of showed me, you know, what, you know, how to combine research and medicine, and really fostered that idea with me, because to be honest with you, I never really wanted to be a clinician. I did not think I was cut from the same cloth as a lot of them.
So what made you want to now pursue, because you've been an academic now for quite a while. You've been
in
academia for, shall I say, over a decade or more than that? A couple of decades?
Yeah.
A couple of decades. And now you're going into medicine, into clinical field.
Yeah.
Which is vastly different, because are you going mm-hmm. to be actually dealing with the human beings?
I will. Yes. Yeah. That's the hope. So that was one of the things the DJ showed me. He took me to clinic with him and took me to the OR, and he showed me that, listen, the ideas that we have in research can be used to inform our clinical practice and vice versa. So, you maybe see something in clinic as well, and you think, oh, that's interesting. I've never thought about studying that. Like, maybe we should think about this and this. And you come back to the lab and you start formulating some new ideas, and they kind of feed off each other, excuse me, feed off each other quite well, which is
Which is what
it was
is
exactly what I was searching for, because I kind of felt in the back of my head, to be completely honest with you, something was missing, and I just wasn't
In
sure
terms of
what
your
that was.
academia, you mean?
Yeah, just I loved academia, and I just something I couldn't put my finger on it. It wasn't until I met DJ. I really give him, a ton of credit, because he opened my eyes and like I said, fostered this idea a little bit, and really pushed me too. He really did, which was awesome. And it's been, now that I'm in this position, I realize that yeah, this is exactly where I'm supposed to be.
So
Um,
how are
and
you
fortunate.
to, let's talk about funding a bit.
Sure.
How are
Absolutely.
you being funded?
I'm fortunate in that I've gotten funding, and I've gotten some awards, but I recognize that I'm an extremely kind of fortunate and privileged position because of that. The funding rate in Canada for the federal government is quite low. It's on the order of 7 to 10% for people in my position, which is, absurd a little bit. That's the And then as you move up in your career to junior faculty to senior faculty, the funding rates get lower and lower. And it seems to be that the people who get them continue to get them, and it's harder to break through that
Ceiling.
barrier. Yeah, exactly. So
And does
it's
that
a
not
tough thing.
curtail research or ideas or innovation, in academia? Does that not limit us as human beings?
It does. It absolutely does. You often you find yourself thinking to yourself, I just told you that I've got funding, but there was many years I didn't. I failed a million more times than I've succeeded, and that's not just in the funding thing, that's in my life. But when you're going through those iterations of funding, you realize when you get rejected, you're like, but I have such great ideas, or you talk to other people and they're like, yeah, these ideas are great. I had the same experience. I was looking at this and this, and if I just had the money to do it, that would be amazing. So, you hit the nail on the head. It's that there's this unequal, uneven distribution, and but it's hard because we're limited by how much the government can actually invest in it, right? So it's a very difficult, academia is not for the faint of heart. I can tell you that right now. There's a lot of failure and letdown in it and critique. But I will say that, if there is joy, and if you enjoy things like looking at data, being published, getting cited, or talking to your colleagues about just science in general, it's extremely gratifying and rewarding.
But
So
isn't it
it's
like
yeah.
also Joe pushing, like you're always like pushing into getting more publications done, getting more citations on, depending on your publications, depending on your citations is where the next like funding
Yeah,
would come from.
absolutely.
And if that is like that much time is devoted to just publications, how much time is then left for exploration and research?
There is this sense of, you know, we often say in academia, publish or perish. Mm-hmm. And there is this sense that you need to get things out. And there's kind of two trains of thought on that. And one is get as much out as you can in as little time. And the other one is, you know, really think about those awesome big ideas and shoot for the moon with them. Mm-hmm. And take your time and be methodical. So to be honest with you, I try and sit in a central, you know, position between those two extremes.
Yeah, because not everything, some things do take time. Some things are longitudinal. They're, you know, depending on the type of research you're doing, some results are kind of immediate, but, you know, most of the results are long-term, like, especially.
Absolutely. You know. Absolutely. And, you know, the people that it's funny because you talk to people maybe who aren't in science and they think, oh, yeah, well, you just do this and this and then you write a paper and that's it. Mm-hmm. You think, well, no, you know, getting a paper front to back or a publication or something like that can take on the order of years sometimes.
Mm-hmm. It's a brutal process.
It is. Mm-hmm. It's, and then, you know, when you think, oh, I wrote a paper, I'll just submit it to a journal. And then the journal comes back and says, no, you're rejected from this journal. There's, you know, even more heartache and headaches, and they give you reviewer comments. And it's tough. You have to address all these things and then either go to a different journal or go back to that one. Mm-hmm. It can take an enormous amount of time. And, you know, I've had a few that have been through, you know, quote unquote, the gauntlet, meaning, you know, we've gone from journal to journal to journal to journal, and we've thought that the ideas were and the paper was fantastic. But at the end of the day, I will say that, you know, a lot of the comments that we got back were really fantastic for some of these articles, and, you know, they made the papers better. So there is, although it takes a long time, it at the end of the day, you know, the community is trying to improve your science, for the most part, I should say.
Yeah. There
is
some. Got to be careful about.
Yeah.
Got to be careful about that part too.
Yes. Yeah.
How do you stay motivated?
Well, you know, obviously, I've done a lot of school, and I'm going to do a lot more going forward as I've mentioned. And The big thing for me, and I've always kind of, I think this has been ingrained in me since a young age, is that you need to keep learning. You know, complacency is the enemy. So if you're not improving, yes, that's exactly it. It is the death.
Yes.
You know, you got to be on this mission of self-improvement. And I do that. I try and do that, you know, in both my learning and, you know, my, you know, personal life as well.
Actually, it would be good to know your routine a little bit, because we're all trying to reconfigure our way of being in this new paradigm. So,
well, one thing for work right now and learning, the big thing for me, especially in this kind of extraordinary time that we're living in right now, is get a little bit of kind of routine.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I wake up in the morning, I make my breakfast, take my dog for a walk, and then I sit down at my desk and review or do some work for a few hours, whether it's reading papers or reviewing some of the data that I've collected. You know, so there is this idea of, I try and read about a paper a day.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it's tough sometimes, though, because I'm not going to lie to you. There is some things that I read that I'm like, this is way over my head. And I like to think I have a decent grasp of a lot of the, you know, kind of neuroimaging, you know, concepts and things like that. But you push yourself a little bit and get out of your comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like we're all doing right now. And yeah, so I'm trying to get a little bit of routine to do that. And then I'll do, you know, maybe a little bit of writing, take some notes,
mm-hmm.
just things like that to try and keep me pushing forward. And then the next day I'll review those notes, review the writing, see if it, you know, because oftentimes what we write down, the next time we come back to it, we realize, yeah, that was maybe not so coherent, or that idea didn't quite make sense. It'd be better if I, you know,
worked
changed
on it further.
Just, yeah, exactly. So that's kind of my mindset right now. And I'm fortunate in that I can do a lot of my work from home, and at least at this time right now. And then, yeah, so it's, I don't know. I'm trying to maintain perspective in all this. And like I said, I'm learning a lot about myself as well. You know,
yeah.
I don't mind being alone, and spending time with my dog and, things like that. So I'm good in that.
Yeah,
respect.
That's a good place to be, to be in. I was just like, it was interesting because I've been thinking that I've been preparing that for this sort of thing for like almost a decade.
Right.
In a way, because I've been collecting data on myself. Writing was it was such a huge part, like writing my daily routines.
Right.
And that idea of like process of self-regulation that I started a long time ago. And now I feel like as if it was in preparation for this particular event.
Right.
And it's very interesting, though, like the sudden shift in terms of, you know, the daily routine, which isn't that dramatic because I'm just trying to figure out where the variables are at and then trying to, you know, coordinate accordingly. Now, I do have a child who's 16 and I have my husband.
Right.
And it's interesting to get all of us kind of on the same sort of routine.
Right.
And this is probably going to be the first time in the entirety of our lives we're going to be kind of like on the same sort of routine. And I'm actually quite looking forward to this experiment myself to see where it leads to. Now, on your personal side of learning, and you're a CrossFit athlete. That's how we met.
Athlete, I would use the term loosely.
I've seen you move. How are you maintaining your physical well-being right now?
That's a really good question. So I work out, or before all of this, I worked out quite frequently at CrossFit Queen Street. And, you know, the community there is awesome and the gym is awesome. And I was doing a lot of Olympic weightlifting as well as CrossFitting. And now, you know, with this, I have to pivot a little bit. And I've been fortunate in that the gym has still maintained, you know, that community aspect through, you know, online things. And you know, they've lent out equipment to, you know, a lot of the members. So I've taken advantage of some of that. And I've got some equipment at home here. And I've got more than enough that I need. And I do a lot of home workouts. And I try and do them, you know, sometime in the day. And it's actually kind of nice to get that stuff. You know, you can do it for, you know, 20 minutes, just, you know, leaving your desk and getting back to your desk, which is great. But the other thing that I've noticed is that it's different, and that, you know, I was mentioning earlier that complacency is the enemy. You know, I've pivoted a little bit. I'm doing a lot more, you know, body weight stuff, or, you know, single dumbbell things, and just movements that I wouldn't normally do. And I'm finding that I actually really enjoy it, which is awesome. And it keeps me centered, for lack of a better word. And what I mean by that is I need to have that physical outlet to keep my mind sharp. And, you know, I've always been like that. Like I mentioned earlier, I played basketball, and then when I was younger, I played soccer. And then, you know, once basketball was done, I, you know, found CrossFit, and it's been a huge part of my life over the last little while. And not only from a physical perspective, but also a mental perspective. You know, get to be around a lot of your you know, friends at the gym, and mm-hmm. you know, unfortunately, we don't get to.
You don't have that close face to face or close interactions, which is also very helpful, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. Helpful for most. I always liked doing my stuff on my own for some reason.
Yeah.
And which works out well now, doing that stuff at home too. And I find, because we're sitting down a lot too, I'm finding, because I'm such a walker, right? I walked mm-hmm. everywhere, walked to work.
Right.
Walked to, because we live right downtown, I walked mm-hmm. everywhere. And now that is kind of curtailed significantly for me. And I'm finding that I am sitting quite a bit.
Right.
Which I started noticing actually after the first week of isolation. I was like, oh my gosh, like I'm spending majority of my time just sitting. I gotta figure out a way to,
right.
you know, not do that much sitting.
So what do you do then? Do you get outside and go for walks at all, or like?
So I do every few days. Like I don't like to go out as much, mm-hmm. just because I don't want to be in contact with anybody.
Right. Right.
So, but every 2 or 3 days, I take all the necessary precautions. Those who know me and seen me walking, I have a distance stick, which is neon red.
Okay.
Which is over 2 meters long, that my husband made for me, and I Fantastic. Use that. And I'm very strict about that. I'm very strict about physical distancing. I mm-hmm. don't allow anyone, or I don't want to be in anyone's space, and I don't want anyone in my space. And I try to get
right.
out of the town if possible, to someplace okay. completely isolated.
Right.
And I like doing training outside anyway, but right now at home, I end up getting up every time I'm up. If I am cooking, which I do a lot, which is one of mm-hmm. my favorite comfort things to do,
amazing.
Is then I'm doing isometrics. You know, I'll stand on like one leg while I'm chopping onions, or I'll,
right.
like I'll, I'm always doing, I'm trying to move as much as I possibly can. And since Lucas, my child, became a teen, I wanted to make sure that there was a space that was dedicated to just movement.
Right.
And so our landing is basically our kind of a micro gym, in which we have all kinds of equipment that I've been collecting now for over a decade, because I trained at night at the hospital, right? That was part right. of my shift work study. So mm-hmm. I'm used to being able to use the kind of small spaces around to be able to do high intensity training. And for the past few months, I've been doing slow movement training, which has been very helpful.
It's amazing, Ruby.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Oh no, it's good, because it's my inflammatory markers were very high, so I wanted to isolate everything and see where everything was at. And so I did slow movement training with my coach Ben Robinson, and then. Which is now was a perfect timing for it, because now I'm utilizing the slow movement training and then building to high intensity training and taking my time doing
that's
that.
That's awesome. That's really awesome. And you find it just helps in your day-to-day psyche as well, or is that just a me thing?
Yeah, no, for sure. Because also I find the more anxious one becomes, I want to do something very meditative, which has always been walking for me. Like I do anywhere from 10 to 15 kilometers, or sometimes even more if possible. Okay. And that was very extremely meditative. And now that kind of is limited, that option. Like I just can't leave the house immediately. Like I have to make sure the timing is kind of right, like where I'm not.
Right.
Now I'm figuring out other ways to to deal with that.
Like you said, we adapt, right?
Or find out variables. And I think it's just like you have skills. Once you develop mm-hmm. those skills, you can then start utilizing those tools, and you can start utilizing in whichever environment that you're kind of placed in, right? I mean, that's what we were talking about, our experiences of having multiple jobs and learning. Kind of, I think for me, it was like what you want to do and what you want to put up with. And what is it that you don't want to do, and which path it is that you don't want to go, and what is considered like, you know, this is not something that I would want to explore or do. Mm-hmm. Because you also come to the realization of how precious time is.
You're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely right. I think, over the last few years, I should say, really realized, I should put a premium on, enjoying doing the things that I enjoy mm-hmm. and not doing the things that I don't. Mm-hmm. And because, in a weird way, life is, sounds cliche, but life's too short. And
it really is, actually.
Yeah. So, and I've had some lessons along the way that have, opened my eyes to that. And I think you're hitting the nail right on the head in that, too many times we find ourselves, or at least I did in the past, in a position where I was doing things that I didn't really enjoy or, didn't find super gratifying. And, I kind of made a deal with myself a while ago that I just wasn't going to do that anymore. And I can be extremely candid in saying that, since I've kind of made those decisions, I've been a whole lot happier in my life. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, deciding, I think that kind of requires a level of not just self-awareness, which is necessary, but also time and space.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which we don't give ourselves.
No, especially nowadays in terms of, everything's instant gratification mm-hmm. with Instagram and Facebook and all of this stuff. And, we're running from place to place and doing 10,000 things.
Well, not right now.
Well, maybe not right now.
Right now, I think we've just put a stop to this. Not even a stop. It's like an abrupt halt, actually.
Absolutely.
To everything. And then I think this is a very interesting time where we will get that space and we will get that time regardless of our situation.
Absolutely.
And hopefully figure out whether individually we want to see the world to be or collectively, definitely, which is what I hope we're aiming for. Where do we collectively want to see our world to be? Not just our city or our province or our nation, but hopefully where collectively, globally, where we want to be as global citizens of this awesome planet that we are inhabiting.
I think you're absolutely right. That's a fantastic perspective. And I hope we come out the other side kind of realizing that. And I can't agree with you more.
Well, Joe, it's been wonderful talking to you.
And thank you so much. It's been wonderful talking to you as well. It's been awesome.
Interesting conversation. And I always like to leave a door open for everyone to come back and join us again and talk about, because these are such amazing and vast ranging and complex topics. It's always to come back and have another conversation. Would you join us for another conversation?
Anytime. Yeah. Rui, it's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you for listening to the Ruhi Sleep and Society podcast, available on ruhisleep.ca. Don't forget to follow us on social media @ruhisleep on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Thank you for listening.